BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, it's 783 days since Russia began its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Today, we're going to talk to two Ukrainian soldiers.
What if Ukraine does lose? We will lose our homes, all our houses, our apartments will belong to Russians. We will be captured in Russian prisons. We will be destroyed.
Can we call this that Ukraine is losing the war if we lose territory? Still, that's a question. What is to lose a war?
Those are the voices of Yarina Chernohus, who was first on Ukrainecast back in December 2022, and a soldier who goes by the call sign Logan. Now, Yarina has been fighting since 2020, actually, whereas Logan has been serving for just the last 6 months. And it's interesting to hear from them, James. Why?
Because this is a difficult moment for Ukraine. Not just my words, Victoria, but those of General Alexander Sirsky, the head of Ukraine's military. He's warned the battlefield situation in the east of the country has significantly worsened in recent days. Not just that, Ukraine's parliament last week passed legislation to help mobilise more troops to fight Russia. But is that enough to boost Ukraine's military numbers? Iran's missile and drone attack on Israel over the weekend as well, once again raising questions over the West's ability to focus on Ukraine and the Middle East.
So we'll be talking to Yarina and Logan all about those issues in today's episode. And given that so much has happened in the past few months, we thought we would update our opening titles to reflect some of those events.
This is Ukrainecast.
Ukrainecast from BBC News.
Evil cannot be trusted. Ask Prigozhin.
You are not dealing with a politician, but with a bloody monster.
Is there a need for a serious opponent? Why?
Ukraine is unbroken, unbowed, and unconquered.
It's not just about Ukraine. It's about the whole future of Europe.
I don't understand what this war is for.
Hello, this is Victoria Derbyshire in the BBC Radio Car.
And it's James Waterhouse here in Kyiv.
And just to let you know, the voices in our new opening titles are, of course, President Zelensky, Yulia Navalnaya, Margarita Simonyan, who is the head of RT, Russia Today, President Biden, Fiona Hill, eminent worldwide Russia expert who's been on the podcast recently, and Victoria Kovalenko, who has been on Ukrainecast several times to tell us about the death of her husband and her daughter as they were trying to escape from their home village. Victoria is now here in the UK with her younger daughter, who must be, what, two-ish, two and a half now? So, yeah, just to let you know who all those people are. And, James, welcome back. You've been off for a while. Why?
Thank you, Vic. Yes, I have. I hope that was all right. I headed home to eat some Easter eggs, and I visited friends who'd recently moved to Abu Dhabi and Dubai. And do you know what? It was interesting because after the Crocus City Hall massacre in Moscow, there were Russian flags blowing in the streets in solidarity because the UAE is somewhere where Russians can still travel to and live and take their holidays. And it certainly felt like a different worldview. And it's a side of the fence that I've not personally crossed. I've never been to Russia. So it was certainly eye-opening in that respect.
Mm. Does Kyiv feel like it has changed at all now you're back? Or when you're in the city, is it as it has been for the last 6, 8, 10 months?
I think in recent weeks, Victoria, there's been a difficult constant for, say, you know, my friends and colleagues here, where the issue at the moment for Ukraine is mobilisation, which we're going to talk plenty about. But there are personal friends whose partners or husbands are now either volunteering to get ahead of being mobilised or finding themselves on the front lines. And I think the inescapable dimension of this war is becoming all the more apparent, where, OK, Kyiv, it's always had to weather missile attacks and it's like so many other cities had to get used to it. But we are talking about Russian advances in multiple areas and the idea of what a Ukrainian loss might look like. And for those who are still motivated to defend their country, which is the overwhelming majority, those dangers associated with doing so just haven't gone away. And so that difficulty is especially prevalent. We had the Russian elections. Few here expected anything other than a Putin landslide victory. So very little changes in that respect. But this war is just twisting and contorting and presenting very difficult questions.
Well, let's talk about some of those issues and mobilisation with two serving members of Ukrainian armed forces. Yarina has been on Ukrainecast before, and we're delighted to say that she is back with us. Hi, Yarina.
Yes, hi, I'm here.
Thank you very much for being with us again and talking to our listeners around the world. And we also have somebody who we've never spoken to before and whose call sign is Logan. Logan, hello, welcome.
Thank you for the invitation.
No, not at all. Why is your call sign Logan?
I just like Marvel movies. That's all.
Right. So we are, what, springtime of 2024. Irina, we last spoke to you back in December 2022. How are you? What's been happening in your world?
Well, our company has already been on the front line almost for 3 years without rotation. Like, as we went to the front line in August 2021, and they are still on the front line. So I've accepted offer to join one unit in Kyiv so I could see my daughter just for a few months, just in this way. And my contract, my first contract, has already ended a year ago, but I'm still in army, and it's okay.
Right.
We are going to do that until we have victory.
Okay, but you must be absolutely shattered, are you?
Well, sometimes I feel something like exhaustion, but the thing is, if we all quit army, or all our state will be occupied like very quickly by Russians. This is like quite good motivation to be in army and to do your best as long as you can while you're alive.
And Logan, you're based in the northeastern, or close to the northeastern city of Kharkiv, and you're involved in what's called artillery reconnaissance electronic warfare. So essentially you're trying to help Ukrainian forces hold the front line. From your perspective, is Kharkiv under as much threat as it's ever been because of Russia building for a big push, which is expected in some quarters?
I would say that if we are talking about Kharkiv, we are trying to do our best in building the defense lines, and Ukrainian soldiers and different companies are working in that. And from my point of view, that our war is on that stage that we have a lot of new technologies providing. And of course, Ukrainian soldiers are exhausted. But now we are trying to fight more with drones. And drones are not enough, of course, but still it helps us a lot. But without more ammunition, we are not capable to build a good level defense, of course. So if you want to fight with Russians well, we need to provide more in technologies. We are trying to do that, but it has to play all together. Air defense, electronic warfare, drones, artillery, rockets, long range. It has to work all together.
And if those don't all work together?
Well, Kharkiv is a very big city. I won't tell you for sure, of course, what will happen, but I hope that we will hold as long as possible, but we are not superheroes, you know. Ukrainians are, yes, we have less army than Russians, but still Russians are pushing. So we need, of course, support of our alliance, yes, to not let Russia move further.
James, in terms of the threat posed by Russia to Ukraine right now, how would you assess it?
It's looking quite threatening at the moment for Ukraine, Victoria. Mm. I think on one hand, you have the whole of Ukraine still being Vladimir Putin's objective, and a lot needs to go wrong for Ukraine in order for that to ultimately be achieved. But Make no mistake, you have Russian forces claiming to have captured hundreds of square kilometres, notably in the east and southeast parts of the front line. You are seeing more Ukrainian-controlled settlements falling. And you have the recent comments of the head of the armed forces, General Oleksandr Sirsky, saying the battlefield situation in the east has significantly worsened in recent days. He's talking about a small town called Chasiv Yar. Sound familiar? It will do to most listeners. We're talking about another small town on a hill, typically a military hub, significant in terms of its transport links with major roads and railways connecting all these towns and villages. I was there when I visited Bakhmut 18 months ago, when the Russian forces were about 8 kilometres away. That tide has come in. And a couple of months ago, we were in cities like Kostantinivka, Kupiansk, which are bracing themselves for what might be over the horizon. So it is incredibly difficult for Ukrainian forces at the moment. And that is why we are seeing them build alternative defensive lines, new trenches. And the political chat is around how much territory is acceptable to concede in the medium term for Ukraine to stay in this fight, and hopefully for its Western allies in its eyes to get behind it. But you hear Logan there talking about the city of Kharkiv. This is a place which has withstood constant Russian attack since the full-scale invasion. There was an attempted insurgency in 2014 when Russia's aggression first started. And should that fall, then I think this war would start to feel very different for Ukraine.
Well, let me ask Yarina and then Logan a really brutal question. Yarina, is Russia slowly winning?
I would say no. Russia is not winning. Absolutely no. Because, you know, if we talk about victory in modern military doctrine, what is victory? Victory is to break the will of your enemy to continue the war. So they haven't broken our will to resist, so they are not winning slowly, but they are trying to push us, of course, and it is really hard for us to fight alone.
Logan?
Well, first of all, I want to mention that coming back 10 years ago, we already has the start of the Russian invasion, and at that time Russia was using her proxy power in Donbas region, and also annexing Ukraine by their own army. And at that time, she was alone. Now, Russia, she has allies. You know them. It's Iran, North Korea, China. So, of course, Russia now has, she feels that she has this window that she can grab as much territory as possible while we have this situation with America, with US, and then from the stronger position to dictate what they want, yes? So can we call this that Ukraine is losing the war if we lose territory? Still, that's a question. What is to lose a war, right? We want to hold as much of territory as possible, and we don't want our combats to die. So we need to find such a way to stop Russia and to hold them as long as possible.
It's so interesting to hear you speak in those terms, because it is the first time on Ukrainecast, as far as I recall, and I'm happy to be corrected, that a member of the Ukrainian military has admitted that it might not be possible to push all of the Russian army out of all of Ukraine.
We are trying our best to fight and to take our territories also back, of course.
We will
do all possible to get our territories back. But at the same time, I just want to mention that we need weapons.
And so, as you'll be aware, Logan, you know, Ukraine's parliament has passed this legislation to help mobilise troops, or more troops, to fight against the Russians. The age has been lowered to 25. It involves men aged 18 to 60 to keep their personal details updated. So if they ever bump into a drafting officer, they can then present them and follow any instructions to enlist potentially. There are financial rewards for volunteers, and there's compulsory training for all new recruits before going into combat. But this has been hugely controversial in Ukraine. Why? Well, it's not about what this bill contains, it's what it doesn't have in it, which is a plan for demobilization. In short, a contract where you say, look, we may compel you to fight, but after, say, 18 months, you would have served your time, you can go back home to your family. And it's there which is proving to be such a sticking point. But the issue of mobilization, and you know, we're, as we've said, we're long past the point of people wanting to volunteer. They already have done so, and they're either still serving or are injured or are dead. We're now at the point of Ukraine trying to mobilize hundreds of thousands of soldiers. The figure was once put at 500,000. The government has since said, look, it's not as much as that now, but what we are seeing is Ukraine trying to pass new laws to try and compel more men to fight for its continued defence. But it's interesting hearing Logan there, where you think, well, you know, the goal for Ukraine's always been simple, survival and complete liberation. But if complete liberation is looking more and more remote, then what are, you know, it makes it that bit more difficult to fight, you would imagine. If you're just holding on for the Russians to either lose interest, for there to be a regime collapse, or for Western support to finally unify once more. So these are really perilous times.
Yarina, what is your view on mobilisation and the need for it?
We really need mobilisation. And the biggest disadvantage of this law that was voted in Parliament is that there is no like actually terming of the end of mobilization. Like we hoped for 36 months, and there is no like think about that you serve for 36 months and then you can go back to your family. And I hope they will add something like that. But the thing is, well, I'm already in army for my fifth year, and I understand that we really need all our resources to continue existing as a state and to not to give Russia a chance to occupy all of our territory.
I understand. What would you say to someone in Ukraine who fits the age profile, who doesn't want to sign up and fight?
Well, I would say that they underestimate that actually army, and the special army, that is very great experience for your life. I'm really proud of my service. I spent like 3 years in a combat position of combat medic in the Ukraine Marine Corps in reconnaissance battalion. I'm really proud of it.
You would say to someone who doesn't want to sign up, you've done it, and you're really proud of what you have achieved. What if that person listens to you and says, but I don't want to die, even if it means I'm defending my country?
Well, I would answer this way. The ones who treat themselves as cowards, in the end, they are mobilized to the army of the enemy. Because if you're not mobilized in this big resistance to your native country, to Ukraine, your army will lose and you will be mobilized to Russian army, and you'll go with Russians to occupy the rest of the Europe, which are for sure their plans.
Okay, so that's a really strong answer. Yeah, that's a really strong answer.
It's not just a numbers game either. There was a very passionate debate on Ukrainian TV last week where some politicians were calling for this demobilization plan, and those in the military were saying it's not as simple as that. We don't have enough trained soldiers. So your officers who've been trained as a soldier over many years, and I think this is what this bill might partly be trying to address. But is that something you agree with, Logan, that even if you can, you know, you have dozens more troops join your battalion, it's the lack of those especially elite fighters or even officers which you need as well to enable people to rotate out?
Well, I will start from that moment that when I signed a contract with Ukrainian forces, army forces, I went for my training to United Kingdom. And as I know, they also have trainings for officers, right, for them. So as we have a good level and a big amount of officers in the army, later on, they will be ready also to prepare our soldiers which are coming from civilian life these days. Of course, we have difficulties. We have difficulties, and Russia, they also have that problem too. But still, Ukrainians are defending their own homes, their own lands, and we don't have other choice than to fight, because everyone in the world could see what happened in Bucha. So we don't want to Ukraine become one big Bucha.
Of course. Right, let's talk about what's happening in the Middle East, because we have a question from one of our listeners, Sasha, on Discord. And Sasha wants to talk particularly about Iran's missile and drone attack on Israel and what that would mean for the war in Ukraine.
It was interesting to hear that when Iran fired a load of missiles and drones at Israel, they were intercepted by Israel's own air defence system, but also some were intercepted by USA destroyers in the Mediterranean Sea and apparently also UK helicopters. I know Iran told everyone with 72 hours notice that they're doing this, so there was time to prepare, so it's a different situation. But I can't help but feel Ukraine is more and more being left out in the cold.
I think President Zelensky would strongly agree with Sasha. I think the sight of Shahed drones, more than 300 of them, travelling towards Israel, only for them to be intercepted with the help of its own allies, the UK, the US, Jordan, was a source of great frustration for President Zelensky. Why? Well, if you look at what he's been asking for, there was at one point in 2022 where he asked for what was called a no-fly zone, where Western allies would patrol Ukrainian skies with jets. And I remember the former UK Defence Secretary, Ben Wallace, at the time, giving this analogy, which was, OK, say if the UK was to provide a jet and it was to shoot down a Russian MiG over Ukraine, then Moscow would have to respond, and that would involve the targeting of another British target. And then you have this back and forth until it escalates into a world war. And we've seen with Ukraine that the West has been very scared of that, frankly. And yet with Israel, it's clearly different. There is clearly more confidence and more coordination among Western allies in supporting Israel in the Gaza war. What does it boil down to? Diplomatic relations, perhaps. The fact that Vladimir Putin has more than 5,000 nuclear warheads, possibly more likely. So it's been a source of great frustration. However, you can be sure that President Zelensky will see this as a diplomatic opportunity. It's what he does.
Modern air defense systems prove that they're capable of protecting lives. This has been demonstrated in the Middle East when they shot down Iranian missiles and Shaheds that were directed at Israel. The whole world can see what real protection is. And the whole world saw that Israel was not alone in this defense. Threats in the sky were also destroyed by the allies. And when Ukraine tells its allies that unity provides the best protection, they already know this very well.
So he will see it as an opportunity, but there are some pretty depressing parallels for Kyiv from the events of the last few days, a few hundred miles further south.
Yarina, if I were to ask you, what if Ukraine loses? I'm guessing you would tell us, and you alluded to this earlier, Ukraine won't lose. You are determined, you are resilient, and Ukraine is doing this for the whole of Europe. But what if Ukraine does lose?
What if Ukraine does lose? Well, we will lose our homes, like all our houses, our apartments will belong to Russians. We will be captured in Russian prisons. And then when they finish their occupation, they will go to smaller European countries like Baltic countries, maybe Poland, and they will take all our resources of all Ukraine to occupy the rest of the Europe. And Ukraine has a huge resource of people and everything. That's what is awaiting. And then all Europe will be engaged in war. So this is the picture which is very frightful for lots of Europeans and people in the world, but this is true. So when we talk that we really need weapons, all world actually needs us to have this, because we'd better stop war here on our territory than the rest of Europeans who don't have the combat experience that we Ukrainian militaries have. Mm. I would stab them more in the center of Europe, more deeper in Europe.
Well, it's a very sobering answer, Yarina, and we're grateful for your time today. Thank you so much. And Logan, thank you very much as well for your time. And we would love to talk to you again. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
James, I mean, that was a really depressing answer from Yarina, which could well be very close to the truth if Ukraine does lose. What if they do lose?
Yeah, I think there are two answers to that. Let's look at the grand scale. Is it possible for democratic countries to halt the imperial ambitions of an authoritarian state? Because we're seeing Vladimir Putin rely on electoral rotations, differing views of amongst Western allies, and he's capitalising and he's been able to sustain his fight because he has the size and authority to do so. Then you have the question of nuclear weapons. Are they just a deterrent, as we've seen throughout the Cold War and post-Cold War era? Or are they also a shield for a dictator to exert their will and to leverage other countries into submitting to those ambitions? And then if we go on the smaller scale, not that small, Ukraine, still a vast country, which at one point had more than 40 million people. Is this the decade when the West was unable to prevent a country, a European country, from falling into the shadows of occupation, where it would no longer exist as a democratic country, where political wills would be ignored, where millions more would be forced to flee, and it would follow the path of Belarus for goodness knows how long, because you can be sure whether Russia installs a puppet government or doesn't even try and hide the fact that it wants to occupy it completely, overtly, and you can be sure it won't give it up in a hurry. Now, look, we are some way off, a million miles off a complete capitulation by Ukraine. But it is important to note the tone of the conversation we've had today and the juncture at which we are at. Now, we understand there could well be a vote on, finally, on a sizable military aid package in the US Congress, which could arrive. But we are now talking about cities maybe falling. And war tends to have a domino effect after months and months of it being so static. So, yeah, if Ukraine was to lose, in short, it would cease to exist as we know it.
Well, I'm sorry that is such
difficult.
It's really awful to say the words out loud, but it will be privately what certain people who are at the heart of this conflict are potentially talking about and possibly even considering. James, thanks for being with us. Are you working on anything in particular at the moment, or are you there on call day and night in Kyiv as news breaks?
Oh, both, Victoria. You know how it is. Mm. Here to serve.
Yep.
We are looking into mobilisation and what it means for those exhausted soldiers on the front line and what it means in the face of continued Russian advances, how Ukraine is having to adapt. And we're also looking at that ongoing political argument of whether there should be a compromise or a calculation of what is an acceptable loss in the short term.
Well, thank you for being with us, as always. I just want to say to our listeners how touching your loyalty is. It's absolutely amazing that so many of you are still listening to us, because there are not that many places now to get information about what's happening in Ukraine. So we're very, very grateful to you all.
And just a reminder, you can get in contact with us, as always, using the usual channels, WhatsApp, Telegram or Signal. Our number is +44 330 123 9480. And you can email ukrainecast@bbc.co.uk.
And we will have another audience Q&A later on in the week. And wherever you are listening in the world, take care.
Goodbye.
Ukrainecast from BBC News.